Where you going, Frank?
Don't tell me not to fly, I've simply got to. If someone takes a spill, it's me and not you. Don't bring around a cloud of terrain on my parade.
Sir, we're going to let him get away.
No, Carl, you let him get away.
Nobody had a better rain on my
Merry Christmas!
Parade.
I'm getting close, huh? You will go to prison.
You're going to have to catch me.
Ladies and gentlemen, the real Frank Abagnale.
Afternoon, it's my pleasure to be here this afternoon. I addressed this group once before, so we went and looked it up today, and that was 25 years ago in Atlantic City here. So a long time, but very happy to be back again to address the group. As you know, most of the time that I walk up to the podium to speak, it's about forgery and counterfeiting, embezzlement, identity theft, and things of that nature. And I will be doing that later on in a breakout session. But today they asked me to start off by talking a little bit about my life, in which the film Catch Me If You Can was made. Interesting to note, I've had a writer write a book about my life, a film director make a movie about my life, and a Broadway producer make a play about my life. All of them I never met, so I can only assume that they were telling a story from their point of view. So I thought today I would just tell you the story from my point of view. I was raised not far from here in Westchester County, New York, in a little town in Westchester called Bronxville. I was actually one of four children in the family, the so-called middle child of the four. I was educated there by the Christian Brothers of Ireland at a private Catholic school called Iona in Rochelle, New York, where I went to school from kindergarten to high school. By the time I reached the age of 16 in the 10th grade, my parents, after 22 years of marriage one day, decided to get a divorce. Unlike most divorces where the children were usually the first to know, my parents were very good about keeping that a secret. I remember being in the 10th grade when the father walked in the classroom one afternoon and asked a brother to excuse me from class. When I came out in the hallway, the father handed me my books and told me that one of the brothers would drive me to the county seat in White Plains, New York, where I would meet my parents and they would explain what was going on. I remember the brother dropped me at the steps of a big stone building, told me go on up the steps, my parents would be waiting for me in the lobby. I remember climbing the steps, seeing a sign on the building that said Family Court, but really didn't understand what that meant. When I arrived, my parents were not in the lobby, but I was ushered into the back of an immense courtroom where my parents were standing before a judge. I couldn't hear what the judge was saying, nor my parents' response, but eventually the judge asked me to approach the bench. I walked up to stand in between my parents. I remember distinctly the judge never looked at me, never acknowledged I was standing there. He just continued to read from his papers and said that my parents were getting a divorce. And because I was 16 years of age, I would need to tell the court which parent I chose to live with. I started to cry, so I turned and ran out of the courtroom. The judge called for a 10-minute recess, but by the time my parents got outside, I was gone. My mother never saw me again for about 7 years until I was a young adult. Contrary to the movie, my father never saw me nor ever spoke to me again. In the mid-1960s, running away was a very popular thing for young people. A lot of them got caught up in Haight-Ashbury, the hippie scene, the drug scene. Instead, I took a few belongings from my home, packed them in a bag, boarded what was then the New Haven and Hartford Railroad for the short train ride down to Grand Central Terminal in New York. My father did own a stationery store, but actually in Manhattan, located on the corner of 40th and Madison, and still there today. Like all of us, we had to work in the store, so I made deliveries for my dad. I knew the city very well, so I started looking for the same type of work. There were a lot of signs on the window, stock boy, delivery boy, part-time. I'd walk in and apply. So tell me, young man, how old are you? 16. How far did you go in high school? 10th grade. I'll hire you. Went to work for a small amount of money. Soon realized I couldn't support myself on that amount of money. I also realized that as long as people believed I was 16 years old, they weren't going to pay me any more money. At 16, I was 6 foot tall. I've always had a little gray hair since I was about 14 or 15. My friends in school used to say that once a week when we dressed for mass, I looked more like a teacher than a student. So I decided to lie about my age. In New York, we had a driver's license at 16. Back then, they didn't have a photo on them, just an IBM card, so I altered one digit of my date of birth. I was actually born in April of 1948, but I dropped the 4, converted it to a 3, and that made me 10 years older or 26 years old. I walked around applying for the same type of work. People gave me a little more money, a few more hours, but even then it was difficult to make ends meet. One of the few things I had taken when I left home was a checkbook. My father had opened a checking account for me at a small community bank in Mount Vernon, New York. I had a little money in the account, so every so often I would write a check to supplement my income. $10, $15, funds were there, checks were good. But it was my friends, my peers, who would say to me, "You know, you're the only guy who walks into a bank in the middle of Manhattan. You have no account there. You don't know a soul. You talk to somebody behind a desk, and they okay your check." "Oh, well, my checks are good. If I walked in that bank, they wouldn't touch my check. You walk in, they don't bat an eye." Years later, reporters would write and speculate that that was my upbringing. Mannerism, speech, whatever it was very easy to do. So consequently, when the money ran out, I kept writing those checks. Of course, the checks started to bounce. Police were looking for me as a runaway. So I thought maybe it was a good time to start thinking about leaving New York City. But I was quite apprehensive about going to Chicago, Miami, wondered if they'd cash a New York check on a New York driver's license in Miami as quickly as they did in Manhattan. I was walking up 42nd Street one afternoon about 5 o'clock in the evening, 16 years old, pondering all of these things when I started to approach the front door of an old hotel that used to be there called the Commodore Hotel, now the Grand Hyatt. Just as I was about to get to the front door of the hotel, out stepped an Eastern Airline flight crew onto the sidewalk. Couldn't help but notice the captain, the co-pilot, the flight engineer, about three or four flight attendants dragging the bags to the curb to load them in the van to take them to the airport. As they loaded the van, I thought to myself, that's it. If I could pose as a pilot, I could travel all over the world for free. I probably could get just about anybody, anywhere to cash a check for me. So I walked up the street a little further to 42nd and Park. I went to cross over. I heard a huge helicopter, so I looked up, and there was New York Airways landing on the roof of the Pan Am building. Pan Am, the nation's flag carrier, the airline that flew around the world. I thought, what a perfect airline to use. So the next day, I placed a phone call to the executive corporate offices of Pan Am. When the switchboard was ringing, I had absolutely no idea what I was going to say. When they answered, "Pan American Airlines, can I help you?" "Yes, ma'am. I'd like to speak to somebody in the purchasing department." "Purchasing? One moment." The clerk came on and said, "Yes, sir, maybe you can help me. My name is John Black. I'm a co-pilot with the company based out of San Francisco. Been with the company about 7 years. Never had anything like this come up before." What's the problem?" "Well, we flew a trip in here yesterday. Going out today. Yesterday I sent my uniform out through the hotel to have it dry cleaned. Now the hotel and the cleaner say they can't find it. Here I am with the flight in about 4 hours. New uniform." "Don't you have a spare uniform?" "Certainly. Back home in San Francisco, but I'd never get it here in time for my flight." "Do you understand that this would cost you the price of a uniform, not the company?" "I understand." "Hold on, I'll be right back." And he came back and said, "My supervisor said you need to go down to the well-built uniform company on Fifth Avenue. They're our supplier. I'll call them and let them know you're on the way. They'll take care of you." Well, that's exactly what I wanted to know, so I went down to the well-built uniform company. Little fellow Mr. Rosen fitted me out in the uniform. Back then there were black Aberdeen, the three gold stripes on the arm, the gray hair. I certainly looked old enough to be the pilot. When he was all done, I said, "How much do I owe you?" "Well, the uniform's $286. I said, "No problem, I'll write you a check." "No, we can't take any checks." "Oh, well then, I'll just pay you cash." "Oh no, we can't accept cash. You need to fill out this computer card. Then in these boxes, put your employee number. And we bill this back under uniform allowance. Comes out of your next Pan Am paycheck." That's even better. Go ahead and do that." New York had two airports, LaGuardia and Kennedy. LaGuardia was 20 minutes from Manhattan. Kennedy was 50. So naturally, LaGuardia being the closer of the two, that's where I went. Spent most of the morning walking around LaGuardia in the uniform, trying to figure out, now that I had the uniform, how the hell do you get on these planes? So I got a little hungry about lunchtime, so I walked in the luncheonette, sat down on the counter on the stool, and ordered a sandwich. Moments later, a TWA crew walked in. The flight attendant sat in the booth, but the pilots up at the counter on either side, captain right next to me. Now, back before deregulation of the airlines, airline people thought of themselves as just one big family. They didn't hesitate a moment to talk to each other, and the captain kind of leaned over. "Hey, young man, how's Pan Am doing?" Doing just fine, Captain. Tell me, what's Pan Am doing out here at LaGuardia? Pan Am doesn't fly into LaGuardia. They only go into Kennedy. Well, I picked up on that right away. Yeah, we came into Kennedy, had a short layover, came over to visit some friends of mine. Matter of fact, I'm on my way back to Kennedy now. So tell me, young man, what type of equipment are you on? Now, airline people have a lot of jargon for things, and one of them is they never call a plane or an aircraft. They call it equipment. And what type of equipment you're on meant what type of plane do you fly? Back then, the DC-8, a 707. Of course, I didn't know that, and I thought, what type of equipment am I on? The equipment I'm on is a stool. They must mean what type of equipment is on the planes I fly. So I thought, well, they've got the wings and they got the engine. They always had a sticker on the engine, who manufactured the engine. So I said, yes, General Electric. All three pilots kind of just stopped eating and leaned over. Captain said, oh, really? What do you fly, washing machines? So I knew I said the wrong thing. Out the door I went. Everybody had an airline ID card, plastic, laminated card, much like a driver's license today. Yeah, without the ID card, the uniform was worthless. Went back to Manhattan, pretty discouraged. I was sitting in the hotel room. I noticed a big, thick Manhattan Yellow Pages. So I pulled them down on the bed, flipped them open, and looked under the word identification. There were three or four pages of companies who made convention badges, metal badges, plastic badges, police badges, fire badges. Started to call around, and finally one company said, listen, most of those airline IDs manufactured by Polaroid, 3M company, need to call one of them. Finally got the 3M company on the phone in Manhattan. Yeah, we manufacture Pan Am's identification system along with a number of other carriers. How come? Say, I tell you, I'm a purchasing officer for a major U.S. carrier. I'm in New York just for the afternoon. We're getting ready to expand our routes, hire a lot of new employees, go to a formal ID. We're very interested in the Pan Am format. Wondered if I came by your office this afternoon briefly, we could discuss quantity and price. By all means, come on by. So I went by dressed in the suit, and the sales rep opened the book. Yeah, we do United, Delta, Eastern, Pan Am. We like that format. Think you might have a sample I could bring back? Sure, I'll be right back. And he brought me back a 5x7 glossy piece of paper with a picture of an ID card blown up in the middle of it, someone else's picture in the picture, John Doe for a name, and in bold red ink across the front, this is a sample only. I said, no, I'm afraid this won't do. You know, I need to bring back the actual physical card. And by the way, what is all this equipment on the floor? We don't just sell the card. We sell the system, camera, laminator. I say, we have to buy all this? Absolutely. Well, I'll tell you what, since we have to buy it all, why don't you just demonstrate how it works and use me? Fine, have a seat right here. Took my picture, made up the card, and out the door I went. I was going down the elevator studying the card. Had a blue border across the top, about a quarter of an inch in Pan Am's color blue, but not a single thing on the card said Pan Am. No logo, no insignia, no name. This was a plastic card, like a credit card. You couldn't type on it, you couldn't write on it, you couldn't print on it. Discouraged, I put it in my pocket, headed back to the hotel. As I was walking back, I noticed I had passed a hobby shop, so I turned around and walked back. Excuse me, sir, I see you sell a lot of models here. You sell models of commercial jetliners? Sure, over there. And I bought a model of a Pan Am 707 cargo jet for about $2.40, took it back to my room, opened the box, threw all the parts out, but there on the bottom of the box was a sheet of decals that went on the model. And when you soaked them in a glass of water, the little Pan Am globe that would have went on the tail of the plastic plane went perfect up at the top of the plastic card. And the word Pan Am and the special styling of graphics that would have went on the fuselage went perfect across the top of the card. And the clear decal on the laminated plastic made a beautiful identification card. Pan Am says they estimate that between the ages of 16 and 18, I flew more than 1 million miles for free, boarded more than 250 commercial aircraft in more than 26 countries. Pan Am says, keep in mind that though Frank Abagnale did in fact pose as one of our pilots, he never once stepped on board one of our aircraft. That's true. I never flew on Pan Am because I was afraid someone might say to me, you know, I'm based in San Francisco. I've been out there about 20 years. I don't recall ever meeting you before. Or someone might say, you know, your ID card is not exactly like my ID card. So instead, I flew on everyone else. If I wanted to go somewhere, I literally just walked out to the airport and looked on the board, United Flight 800 to Chicago. Then I went downstairs to the door marked United Operations and walked in. The operations clerk, hey, Pan Am, what can we do for you? I was wondering if the jump seat's open on 800 on the deadhead to Chicago. Jump seat's open this evening. Like to get a pink slip pass. I'd give him my ID, he'd write me out a pass, I'd walk out, hand it to the flight attendant, she'd open the door to the cockpit, and I'd step in. They had a captain, a co-pilot, a flight engineer, and a seat behind the captain called the jump seat, where pilots deadhead on company time. Now, because pilots love to talk shop, once you picked up that jargon, it was the same conversation over and over and over. So I just step on board, Bob Davis flying to Chicago. On the taxi out, always the same question. So, Bob, how long have you been with Pan Am? Been flying about 7 years. What position do you fly? A right seat, which is airline terminology for a co-pilot. What type of equipment were you on? Had that one down. Perfect. Matter of fact, whatever they flew, I didn't fly, so I had no problem with that. Then we'd arrive in Chicago, I'd go by the Pan Am ticket counter, but just enough to get the attention of the passenger service rep. Is it going to help you? Excuse me, where do we lay over here? The dead end of trip, never laid over in Chicago. Yes, sir, we lay over at the Parma House Hilton downtown, catch a crew bus lower level door 3 up. I go down the Parma House Hilton, walk in, and on the corner of the registration desk was a little sign that said Airline Cruise. That was a 3-ring binder. You signed in, referenced your flight number, showed your ID. They'd give you a key. I'd stay 2 or 3 days, and Pan Am would be direct billed for my room and my meals. I also could cash a personal check up to $100 at the front desk because the airline had a contract with the hotel, and they'd cash your check. But then I found out that every airline honors every other airline employee's personal check, a reciprocal agreement still practiced today in 2010. So at the Newark airport, a Delta flight attendant can walk over to Continental Airlines, show her ID, and cash a personal check up to $100, and vice versa. Of course, when I found that out, I'd go out to JFK, LAX, only I'd go to everybody, Northeast, National, KLM, Air France. It would take me a good 8 hours, stopping at every counter in every building. By the time I got all the way around the airport, at least 8 hours had gone by. What do you have in 8 hours? Shift change, new people, so I'd go all the way back around other way. I made a great deal of money. The only reason I quit at 18 is the FBI issued a John Doe warrant for interstate transportation of fraudulent checks, a federal offense. The John Doe warrant meant the FBI didn't know my identity. In the warrant, the FBI said, based on interviews with people I had contact with, I was approximately 30 years old. I was 18. Had a great deal of money, so I hung the uniform up and moved to Atlanta, Georgia. In Atlanta, I moved into a very swank singles complex that had just been built called the Riverbend Apartments. On the application for the lease, there were a lot of questions for a teenage boy. One of them was occupation. So I began to write down airline pilot, but the next question said employed by, supervisor's name, telephone contact. I thought to myself, I'll need to come up with something that would be impossible to check out. Something that would justify why I drive an expensive car, wear expensive clothes, don't work much. So I wrote down the word doctor. First thing came to my mind, nothing else, but I had a very inquisitive apartment manager. Oh, I see here you're a doctor. Yes, ma'am. What type of doctor are you? Well, I'm a medical doctor. However, I'm not practicing medicine right now. I left my practice out in Los Angeles to come to Atlanta to invest in some real estate I have. How interesting. Well, tell me, what type of medical doctor are you? And I figured, being a singles complex, pediatrician would be pretty safe. So I moved in, Dr. Frank Williams, pediatrician. Now everybody called me Doc, always the typical questions at the pool. So Doc, where'd you go to medical school? Columbia University, New York. Where'd you serve your internship? Harvard Children's Hospital, out in LA. Once in a while, when the guys would come by, hey Paul, hey Doc, look at my leg. I don't know what I did to it, look at this. Paul, I can't examine your leg. You need to go to your own doctor and have him look at that. When the girls came by, I just gave them a thorough examination, sent them on their way. I was young, but not stupid. I was living there for about 2 or 3 months. Everything was going great. One afternoon, there was a knock on the door. Very distinguished gentleman, mid-50s. Yes, sir, can I help you? You are Dr. Williams? Yes? My name's Gordon. Just moved in the apartment down below. Wanted to come up and introduce myself. Ah, new neighbor. Come on in. Not only a new neighbor, understand that you're a pediatrician. Yes. I'm the chief resident pediatrician of the county hospital up the street. Dr. Gordon was going through a divorce, just separated from his wife. He was very upset, very lonely. Every day on the way to the car, out to the pool, he'd stop me. After a minute or two about the weather, he'd start speaking medical terminology. Not being able to converse with him, I in turn would cut him short. But I knew eventually he'd get suspicious. Determined not to move, every day I went to Emory University's medical library. Every day I read the daily journals from Johns Hopkins, the Mayo Clinic. Every day I took a certain part of the journal, memorized it in detail. And every night when Dr. Gordon pulled in his parking slot, literally without exaggeration, every night, I was on his doorstep. Era. Hey, about this new theory they're using up at Mayo? What is it tonight? And I'd follow him into his apartment. Aggravated, he'd go in his bedroom to get undressed. I'd go in his bedroom, sit on the edge of the bed. In the kitchen, I'd talk through up and down. Go to the bathroom, I'd talk through the door. Pretty soon, he'd come home. Hey, Doc, I don't have time to talk to you right now. I got to go. Guys started to avoid me, which is exactly what I wanted. One afternoon, I received a phone call from the hospital administrator, who is not a physician, but the administrator of the hospital. Dr. Gordon suggested I give you a call, said you'd be more than happy to help us out. Now, it's a problem. On the midnight date shift, I have a resident supervising a number of interns, nurses on a shift, just been notified of a death in his family. He's returning to the West Coast tomorrow for about 2 weeks. And Georgia law requires a house doctor on duty be a full practitioner or a specialist. Dr. Gordon suggested that you had a great deal of free time. You'd be more than happy to cover the shift in an administrative capacity. There's no way I could do that. Why not? I'm not licensed to practice medicine in the state of Georgia, just the state of California where I hold my residency. All the red tape for 2 weeks? No red tape. We'll bring it before the medical review board tomorrow morning. You issue a temporary certificate. You can start tomorrow night. Now, being one who hates to pass up a challenge, I couldn't help but give it a shot, so I went up to the hospital. During the entire 2 weeks, no one doubted for a second I was not a doctor. When the doctor returned, he relieved me, and I left the hospital, no one the wiser. I did pass the bar in the state of Louisiana, not in 2 weeks as the movie implied, but in 2 months by taking the prep course for the bar. Actually, at the time, Louisiana did not require a law degree to take the bar. Louisiana practiced their law under the French Napoleonic Criminal Code of Procedure. I passed the bar in Louisiana, was licensed in the state, went to work for then Attorney General P.F. Grimion in the civil division of his court, where I spent about a year on my own. I resigned and left, no one the wiser. A lot of people say, you know, it's not so much the people you impersonated as a teenage boy as it is the crimes you perpetrated as a teenage boy. Well, I did a lot of things that had just never been done before, so they got a lot of attention. I was walking down a Chicago street one day counting five $20 bills in my pocket. As I was counting them, I noticed I'd passed the front door of a bank. There was a sign in the window said, "Open a checking account." So I thought to myself, I'll go in this bank and open a checking account with this $100. I'll give him this phony Pan Am ID for identification. In 2 weeks, this bank will mail me 200 printed checks in a box with this name and with this ID. I'll cash them anywhere. So I walked in, opened the account. New accounts person came back. So here's a receipt for your deposit. These are some temporary checks. We'll be mailing you your printed checks in about 10 days. Now, being young, I was always inquisitive. So I noticed, Miss, that you didn't give me any deposit slips. No, sir, they come from the check printer. Be in the back of your checkbook, printing your name, your address, your account number. You get them in about 10 days. Ah, I see. I was just curious, you know, if I want to make a deposit tomorrow, next week. Not a problem. You see the table in the lobby? Has all the forms on it. Just help yourself to a blank deposit slip. In this box, just write your account number in I just gave you. Use those till you get your printed one. So I walked over, took a big stack of them off the shelf, went back to my hotel, couldn't sleep, kept staring at them on the dresser. So the next day I went out and bought what was called the Burroughs 1000 magnetic encoder. Looked like a big green calculating machine. And I magnetically encoded my account number the bank had assigned to me the day before on the bottom of every one of these blanks. I then went back to the bank, put them on the shelf in the lobby, and everyone who came in put their check directly in my account. I was at the Logan Airport in Boston. I was trying to catch a flight. It was about 11:45 at night. I ran out to the airport. The whole airport was closing down. Rent-a-cars, gift shops, ticket counters. Walked up to the ticket counter. Excuse me, you're closing the airport? Actually, the airport lies in the heart of the city. It comes under the government's noise abatement control program. We have no jet operations after midnight. Next flight out is at 6:30 in the morning. I sat down wondering what to do. I noticed they were sticking all their cash and receipts in these big bank bags. Then they'd zip them closed, lock them, put them under their arm, walk around the counter and down the hall to the bank that was in the terminal. They'd stick their key in the night box, open it, drop the bag down the chute, make sure it went all the way down, closed it, locked it, one right after the other, Hertz, Avis, Delta, Eastern, Dobbs House, dropping the bag. I didn't give this a lot of thought, but I came back to the airport the next night, about 11:45. I had rented a bank guard uniform from a costume store in Boston, hung a beautiful sign over the night box, said, "Night box out of order, please leave all deposits with guard on duty." Everyone did. I was a nervous one sitting there going, how the hell can a box be out of order? I mean, that's like a mailbox out of order something. Of course, like any criminal, sooner or later you get caught, and I was no exception to that rule. I was arrested actually just once in my life at the age of 21 by the French police in a small town in southern France called Montpellier. French police taking me into custody actually on a Swedish warrant from the Swedish police who were looking for me for forgery. When the French authorities took me into custody on that warrant, they realized I had forged checks all over France and refused to honor the warrant and the request for extradition. They later convicted me of forgery and sent me to French prison. I served my time in a place called the Maison d'Arrêt, the House of Arrest, in a small town in southern France called Perpignan. Steven Spielberg told Barbara Walters it was extremely important to me to go back to the exact prison, to the exact cell. And he did so, recreating it from the logbooks from the actual prison. He said that there was a blanket on the floor, a hole in the floor to go to the bathroom, no plumbing, no electricity. He said, according to the logbooks, I entered the prison at 198 pounds and left the prison at 109 pounds. When my sentence was up in France, I was extradited to Sweden, where I was later convicted of forgery in a Swedish court of law and sentenced to prison in Sweden, in Malmo, Sweden, at a penitentiary there. When my sentence was up in Sweden, U.S. federal authorities returned me to the United States, arraigned in U.S. federal court. A United States federal judge sentenced me to 12 years in federal prison. I served four of those 12 years in a federal prison in Virginia. When I was 26 years old, the government offered to take me out of prison on the condition I go to work for an agency of the federal government for the remainder of my sentence or until my parole had been satisfactorily completed. I agreed and was released. This year, I'm celebrating 36 years with the FBI. I've worked for the Bureau where I work today and have worked for 36 years. I make my home in Charleston, South Carolina, where I live with my wife of 33 years and my three sons. My youngest boy is 26. He graduated from the University of Beijing in China. He went on to get his master's degree at the University of Beijing. He reads, writes, and speaks Chinese fluently. He's 26 years old. He works for an American company in Beijing. My middle son lives in Charleston, South Carolina, where he and his wife operate a business there. He graduated from University of Nevada in Las Vegas. And my oldest boy, who is now 31, graduated from University of Kansas, went on to Loyola School of Law in Chicago to get his law degree, passed the bar in Illinois, went on to make his dad very, very proud. He's an FBI agent in our counterintelligence unit in Baltimore, Maryland. As many of you know, I had very little to do with the movie. I received no money from the movie because of my work with the government. I did not participate in the making of the movie. However, my family and I felt very relieved that it was, in fact, Steven Spielberg who decided to make that movie. We felt that he went out of his way not to glorify the things I did, but to simply tell the story about what I did. 1 month before the release of the film, and a special by Barbara Walters on the making of the film, Steven Spielberg told Barbara Walters, though I've never met Frank, it was an honor to make the film because I did not immortalize him for what he did 40 years ago. I immortalized him for what he's done for his country for more than 36 years, unquote. In the end, my family and I were very pleased with the outcome of that film. As many of you know, it's now been made into a Broadway play that opens on Broadway in the spring of next year. And, of course, the musical is done by Mark Shaiman, who did Hairspray, and is, of course, the Steven Spielberg of Broadway. And he's brought it to a Broadway play, which opens. So, consequently, I get a lot of emails constantly back in Washington. They never stop. They come from people as young as 8 to people as old as 80. Somebody seeing the film for the first time on TBS, somebody renting the movie for the first time, someone reading about the play. It's always interesting. Most of the people who send the emails are not looking for a response. They just want to make a statement. Some write and say, you know, you were brilliant. You were an absolute genius. I was neither. I was just a child, 16 years old. Had I been brilliant, had I been a genius, I don't know that I would have found it necessary to break the law in order to just simply survive. While I know that people are fascinated by what I did 40 years ago as a teenager, I've always looked upon it as something that was immoral, illegal, unethical and truly a burden I live with every single day of my life. There are many who write and say, well, you know, you were certainly gifted. That I was. I was one of those few children that get to grow up with a daddy. The world is full of fathers. But there are very few men worthy of being called daddy by their child. I had a daddy who loved his children more than he loved life itself. Steven Spielberg would later write that the more I researched Frank's youth, the more I couldn't help but put his father in the film through the likes of Christopher Walken. My father was a man who had four children, three boys, and a daughter. Every night at bedtime, he'd walk into your room. He was 6'3". He would drop down on a knee, kiss you on the cheek, pull the cover up, and he'd put his lip upon your earlobe and whisper in your ear, I love you very much. He never missed a night. As I grew older, I sometimes fell asleep before he got home, but I always woke up the next morning, knew he had been by my bedside. Years later, my older brother joined me in my room temporarily. He was in the Marine Corps. He was 6'4". He went on to play semi-pro football for Buffalo, but when he came home on leave, my father would walk around to his bed, hug him, kiss him, whisper in his ear. He loved him. When I was 16 years old, I was just a child. All 16-year-olds are just children. As much as we'd like them to be adults, they're just children. And like all children, they need their mother and they need their father. All children need their mother and their father. All children are entitled to their mother and their father. And though it is not popular to say so, divorce is a very devastating thing for a child to deal with and then have to deal with the rest of their natural life. For me, a complete stranger said I had to choose one parent over the other. There was no choice to make, so I ran. How could I tell you my life was clamorous? I cried myself to sleep till I was 19 years old. I spent every birthday, Christmas, Mother's Day, Father's Day in the hotel room, somewhere in the world where people didn't even speak my language. And the only people that associated with me were people who believed me to be their peer, 10 years older than I actually was. I never got to go to a senior prom, a high school football game, or even share a relationship with someone my own age. I always knew I'd get caught. Only a fool would think otherwise. The law sometimes sleeps, but the law never dies. I was caught. I went to some very bad places. My boys have grown up asking their mother, why is it that Dad wakes up in the middle of the night and goes down the TV room? Because he doesn't turn the TV on. He just sits there all night. Because there are things you can't forget. Things you're not meant to forget. While I was sitting in that pitch-black cell, my father was climbing the subway stairs in Manhattan as he did every morning, 57 years old, in great physical shape. He just happened to trip. He reached his arm out to break his fall. He slipped. He hit his head on a rail. He landed at the bottom of the step. He was dead. I didn't know he was dead. I was sitting in that cell thinking about him, how much I loved him, missed him, couldn't wait to see him, hold him, hug him, kiss him, tell him how sorry I was. But I never got the opportunity to do that. I was very fortunate because I was brought up in a great country where everyone gets a second chance. I owe my country 800 times more than I could ever possibly repay it for the opportunities it's given me these past 36 years. That is why I'm at the FBI today, 26 years beyond my legal obligation to do so. I have turned down three pardons from three sitting presidents of the United States because I do not believe, nor will I ever believe in my lifetime, that a piece of paper will excuse my actions, that only in the end my actions will. I was very fortunate that 34 years ago on an undercover assignment in Houston, Texas, I met my wife. When the assignment was over, I refused to leave. I broke protocol to tell her who I really was. Didn't have a dime to my name. I eventually asked her to marry me, against the wishes of her parents, she did. Now, I could sit up here and profess to be a born-again Christian. I could tell you that prison rehabilitated me, or I could take a cheap shot and just say I was a kid who made some mistakes and grew up. But the truth is, God gave me a wife. She gave me three beautiful children. She gave me a family, and she changed my life. She and she alone. Everything I have, everything I've achieved, who I am today, because the love of a woman and the respect three boys have for their father, something I would never, ever jeopardize. There comes a time in all of our lifetimes we grow older and we have children. And as every parent in this room knows, whether your child is 3 months old or 31 years old, when you lay your head on a pillow at night, no matter where that pillow is, and you are just about to close your eyes, the last thing you think about, the last thing you worry about, are your children. So if you still have your mother, you still have your father, you give them a hug. You give them a kiss. You tell them you love them. And to those men in the audience, both young and old, I would simply share with you a lesson I truly learned in my life. What it takes to really be a man. It has nothing to do with money, achievements, skills, accomplishments, degrees, professions, positions. A real man loves his wife. A real man is faithful to his wife. And a real man, next to God and his country, put his wife and his children as the most important thing in his life. Steven Spielberg made a wonderful film, but I've done nothing greater, nothing more rewarding, nothing more worthwhile, nothing that's brought me more peace, more joy, more happiness, more content in my life than simply being a good husband, a good father, and what I strive to be every day of my life, a great daddy. It's been a pleasure. God bless you, and thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, Frank Abagnale. That was very powerful. Thank you, Frank, for your personal and entertaining insight into your life. If you want to hear more from Frank, sit in on his session this afternoon, The Art of the Steal. He will provide the latest information to protect your companies from embezzlement, forgery, internet fraud, and identity theft. Also, I should mention that Frank has authored 5 books. I picked up one recently, and it was a fascinating read. So again, thank you very much, Frank. I'd like to now introduce our next speaker, David Palitziner. Please help me in welcoming Mr. Palitziner.
That was very inspiring, Frank. Thanks for everybody, from everybody. The fallout from the public and political furor over corporate fraud poses many challenges to the accounting profession.